Thank you. I have to say, I love being responsible for the vendors. I just love sitting in the sitting back and listening to everybody learn. So we're going for peak efficiency tonight. We're actually going to finish on time tomorrow. So there's a narrow narrow set of things I want to accomplish. This is the first of four. So I want to define some key terms. And then I want to complicate those definitions, show the possibility that those definitions changed over time. And then the one piece that I think is original, which you can decide if whether it's revenue authority or not, is I want to roll back one of the changes. Okay, that's our agenda for the next 40 minutes. Okay, so we'll start with Brightfield as an intellectual warm-up exercise. So 10 people strike somebody with rods and he dies. Everybody agrees that if they strike him consecutively, that there's no liability. Okay, now at least two possible scenarios you can imagine. One scenario is that 10 people each strike him with a force necessary, with one-tenth of the force necessary to kill him. Collectively they add up to enough force to kill him. The other is that each of them strike him with force that is independently sufficient to kill him. Okay, so we're going to bracket the first case where 10 people each strike him with one-tenth force, because we're going to say that there, it's obvious we understand why no one is liable, because nobody actually struck a killing blow, or we can say technically that nobody could have struck him with intent to kill, because they use minimal force. But if 10 people strike somebody simultaneously, each with a killing blow, so why is it that nobody is liable? So one possibility is a lack of knowledge, right? 10 people strike somebody simultaneously. We don't know who killed it. Okay? Or, yeah?
How can you hold 10 people liable for killing one man?
Or actually, we do know that all, right? We know that all 10 struck simultaneously, so either they're all liable or not. It's not a lack of knowledge. It's just that you can't hold more than one person liable for the same result. This is actually a problem in analytic philosophy also, that whether it's possible for a single effect to have multiple causes. Right, whether the cause of you, every effect has to have a single cause. Okay, that's pretty straightforward, and that tells us absolutely nothing about death. It only tells us about murder. But then we get into the next case. The next case is 10 people strike him consecutively. So 10 people strike him consecutively, though there again we have the question, is it that 10 people strike him each at a 10% blow, or 10 people strike him with the force, each of them with enough force necessary to kill him, it just takes time. So if each of them strike him with 10% force, so then it's pretty clear the last person should be liable. So we're going to bracket back eight, because really each of the others struck a blow that was not sufficient to kill, and then he struck a blow sufficient to kill. Right? In the same way, it doesn't make sense if, if somebody scratches, not terribly morbid, there isn't any way up, there's not morbidly, all right? So there's morbidly possible, right? Somebody scratches your neck, and then somebody else takes the sword, right? So you're only liable for murder because you scratched them first. Right? Obviously, it's the sword.
You're making a function that if you get 10%, what if you scratch 20%, it was the fifth person that killed them.
Right. That's fine. Well, you're right. We could come with we could make the case different for the first five people and the last five people. Right, so we're going to assume, since we asked this, that since it gives 10 people, I'm going to assume all 10 people have to be in roughly the same boat. Right, that's a fair question. Okay, so in this case, however, we have a dispute. Right, if the 10 people strike him consecutively, there's a dispute where the anonymous opening position says they are exempt, but Rabbi Yehuda ben Patera says that the last person is liable. With an interesting phrase, he says, Shekirev et Nisato, because he brought the death closer. Okay, what's the basis for this dispute? Why does Rabbi Yehuda ben Patera say that you're liable and they say you're exempt? So the Talmud, first of all, quotes Rabbi Yochanan, who makes it a cool biblical interpretation debate. It says anybody who is makek kol nefesh, so does the makek kol nefesh mean all of a nefesh or anything which is a nefesh? Right? Any little bit of nefesh or all nefesh? Okay, good. If it's about verses, then it has absolutely nothing interesting to say to us. It's really about verses, we're just going to forget about that for now. It's just cool. The interesting question is that Talmud then goes on to say, aha, you know what? Rava comes along and says we need to analogize and narrow this dispute. Rabbi comes along and he says, you know what? Both the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda would agree that if you kill somebody who is a treifa, that you're not liable. How does this relate to the previous case? So presumably it means that when the tenth, in the case of consecutive blows, by the time the tenth person hits him, he is already a treifa. He might be a treifa. Let's say it that way. We're going to have it, he's not. So why is it, if you kill a treifa, everybody agrees that you're not liable. So what's a treifa? Rashi says a treifa is somebody who has their trachea and esophagus cut away. Well, they're not dead, because it takes a while to bleed out. Or as I have oxygen deprivation, all the right, this is early morbid share. They turn into a zombie, whatever it may be, right? So everybody agrees that if you kill a treifa, then you're not liable. And Rashi says the reason for that is that you're considered to be already dead. Tosfos say that this applies even according to somebody who believes that a treifa can live more than 12 months. Now that seems to expand the definition of treifa lots, so not too many people can live for 12 months with both their trachea and esophagus severed. Right, so obviously we are excited. And it's really quite astounding to say that somebody who can live with 12 months is already dead. I think there was a movie some years ago called DOA, where somebody had been poisoned, they had 24 hours to find the other person before they died. Now imagine that film, right, where you get a year. Right, as opposed to killing you in a year, but right, if somebody's tried to kill you, right, it doesn't have quite the same dramatic suspense. To say that somebody's already dead because they're going to die of something in a year is a quite dramatic thing. And if we look at Tosfos, we'll see that Tosfos may not offer the same logic as Rashi. Rashi, who gives a dramatic case of somebody who actually has, somebody who actually has their trachea and esophagus cut, says, why are you exempt? Because he's already dead. Tosfos says, why are you exempt? Because in the end, he will die of this wound. So I want to argue, there's a fundamental difference in understanding the case. One possibility is, what we're debating, right, when we say that you're exempt for killing a treifa, one possibility is you're exempt for killing a treifa. Why? As Rashi says, because a treifa is dead. Okay, don't be fooled, right? The rumors of his lack of demise are greatly exaggerated. Right, because really, right, really he's dead, even though it takes 12 months. Tosfos says, it's not because, yes, sorry.
So, by this logic, anybody with a terminal illness can be killed by anyone without consequence?
Without biblical consequence. If we think that's what a treifa is. But we don't, right? All we know is we have an extreme definition of a treifa, which is somebody who has a trachea and esophagus cut. And then we have a hint in Tosfos that it must have a broader definition, but we haven't been given that definition yet. And you're saying anybody will see that that's going to be very problematic, right, with that notion, because it's not true. Not everybody who's dying is a treifa. Right, some of them are ghost assumers, we'll see in a moment. Right, and perhaps some of them are zombies. Yes?
Can you make someone a treifa?
Yes.
So, according to Rashi, that would be an act of murder.
Good question. If you make someone a treifa, is that murder? Probably not also. Probably if you, right, that's one of the cases where you can murder people by degrees. So we'll have to figure out, right? Because if you cut somebody's trachea and esophagus, presumably that is murder. Right? So let's play this out. I want to say there are really two ways of understanding it, and those are going to play out through the whole conversation. One way of understanding it is, the reason you're exempt for killing a treifa is that he's already dead. That's what Rashi says. It's a gavra kasila. The other possibility is you're exempt for killing a treifa because he's already been killed, which is not the same thing, because you can, right, because that's just the same case as the case of 10 people striking somebody consecutively. So according to the position of the Chachamim that the 10th person is exempt, why is he exempt? Because people 1 through 9 already struck killing blows, and you can't kill him over and over again. He's not dead yet, but he's already been killed. Because it's possible to commit the act of murder, and now we're just waiting, right, there's a condition. In order to be held liable for murder, you have to kill somebody and they have to die. But the, right, but the action actually takes place at the moment that you kill them. So if somebody has already struck a killing blow, you can't be, right, you can't be liable for killing them. And that's the dispute between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim. Rabbi Yehuda said you can be if you made him die faster. And in fact, if you make him die faster, you remove the liability from the others. And even though they'd already killed him, because it turns out that he died before the condition of their murder was fulfilled. Okay, so these are two really, really, really broad conceptions, I think, and I think that's the dispute between Rabbi Yehuda and Chachamim. Rabbi Yehuda, Chachamim say that he's exempt because he's already, or two ways of understanding it. One way is that the ground for exemption is that he's already dead, and one way is the ground of exemption is that he's already been killed. Okay, so Rava says everybody agrees about a trade-off. Now the question, and everybody also agrees, that if you have this thing called a goseth at the hands of heaven, you kill a goseth who became a goseth naturally, that is murder. Okay, the problem is, what is a goseth? But there's something in the same universe as a trefa. Right? A trefa, if you kill them, nobody thinks you're liable for execution, either because they're already dead or because you already killed them. But there's a goseth at the hands of heaven, that everyone agrees, if you kill them, that is murder. Now, why is that? Presumably, so he's not dead. It's not that. What's the big deal? Why should a goseth be different than anybody else? There are no ways yet. Okay, but it turns out that the nafka mina of their dispute, according to Rava, is for a goseth at human hands. They have a category of somebody who was made a goseth because of things other people did to him. So what does that mean? So the one person compares a goseth at human hands to says that person's like a traceless in your exempt, and one person says if you kill someone who was made a goseth by human hands, then it's just like a goseth to hands of heaven, you're liable. So what's the difference between them? They say that the operative thing is that a goseth at the hands of heaven has not been the object of an action, and this has been the object of an action. So what's the key parameter? The key parameter is, has he already been killed? A goseth at the hands of heaven has not had anyone else kill them. They could be a lot closer to death than a traitor. But it doesn't matter. They're not dead. And as long as you're not dead, if somebody kills you, they're alive. The other person says, no. The issue is that the issue is whether an action has been done. Sorry, that's the first one, the action is done. The second one says, the issue is whether the simanim has been cut. There's something technical about being a trefa. Being a trefa makes you dead. Being a goseth, even though you're dying, you're not dead. Being a trefa makes you dead. Okay, so our two underlying positions are, one position is that you're always liable for murder if the person is alive and no one else has killed them. The other thing says, no, there are people who are alive, but not really. Trefas are alive, but not really. What's the difference between a goseth and a trefa? So all the Talmud says is that a trefa actually has his simanim cut, and a goseth does not. A trefa has a particular set of physical conditions, and a goseth does not. So it's not about the inevitability of their death. It's not about the nearness of their death. Because again, when you kill a goseth, you're liable. You kill a trefa, you're not. Even though a trefa can live for a year. But there is a physical condition called being a trefa that makes you already dead. Okay, that's the underlying definition that matters to us. It's right to understand defining our terms is that a trefa is somebody who has a particular kind of physical condition that will kill them. A goseth is somebody who is dying but doesn't have that physical condition. And a legal thing that works out is that a trefa is dead and a goseth is not. Assuming that our criteria is, right, you're already dead as opposed to
as opposed to we're interested in whether you've already been killed. We'll see why that matters at the end. Okay, what does Maimonides do? Maimonides says that if you kill a healthy person or a sick person tending towards death, even if you kill the goseth, he's executed, right? No matter how, right? So you have healthy, you have sick person tending towards death, you have goseth, who's more than tending towards death. It's still murder. However, if the goseth is the result of human action, so then you don't kill him. Why? Because he's already been killed. And not that he's not alive, but he's already goseth. Right, two people are in the exact same medical condition. Called goseth. One of them is that way because God put them that way. One of them is there because human beings put them that way. If you kill the person whom God put that way, you're liable because you're the one who killed him. If you do it to the person whom another person put that way, you're not liable because the other person killed him, not you. Okay? And that's why you're not liable for ghosts at the hands of human beings. If you kill a trefa, now they're going to add some sequencing to the description of trefa. The trefa is walking around and eating in the marketplace, living a perfectly ordinary life, indistinguishable on the outside from any other human being. Right? In fact, the trefa looks exactly like me. Okay? Because I have at some point had a puncture in my lung casing. That is one of the cases that makes someone a trefa. So you look exactly like me. Not murder. Hopefully this is not tempting anything. So we have a trefa. Now we have somebody who can be walking and talking in the marketplace, live for 12 months, and nonetheless it's not murder to kill them. So you have somebody on their deathbed, dying of some terrible illness, and that is murder. That's the paradox that's going to shape all of Jewish life, end-of-life ethics, is that it's not the imminence of death that drives it, and there are people whose death is imminent who nonetheless it's murder to kill, and there are people whose death is not imminent who it's not murder to kill, although it's still wrong. Yes?
Is trefa always something that's caused by somebody else?
No.
So then how does that drive the view that what distinguishes trefa?
Good. So the end is going to be is that we're going to say that a trefa, everybody agrees, because whether it's because somebody, right, because a trefa is unquestionably dead in some sense. But then the ghost takes the day of dawn, that becomes a dispute as to whether what happens if they're alive but somebody else killed them first. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Yeah, but why would if a ghost takes the day of dawn, is it okay to kill because
yeah.
They've already been killed by somebody else.
So if somebody else made you a trefa,
right.
So yeah, so your interesting question is what, right, so it would seem to be that a trefa, okay, so what you want to say is a gosis de adam is a machloket. Why isn't the trefa a machloket? Right, that's the question you want to ask?
Yeah.
Right, so the answer is everybody agrees a trefa is dead, but it might be there are two reasons behind trefa, or it might be only one. Okay, excellent question. Okay, so the first thing I want to introduce, which is somewhat original today, is that usually discussions, halachic end-of-life conversation, are only about trefa, goseth, and bidei adam versus bidei shemayim. And I actually think there are three categories. There's the trefa, the goseth, and the zombie. And you ask, where does the zombie come in halacha? So the answer is there's a shilta to Rabbi Chaigon, which we're going to read together, which says something quite astonishing. It says, well, there's a person who fell, and his neck broke in two, with most of the flesh cut apart along with it. Okay, so, right, somebody falls from a 30-story window, God forbid, and they have a broken neck. So, okay, what are they? Could be their trefa, could be their ghost. No, what we say about them is, even though his neshama has not yet departed, he is dead. So it's a body. The body can move in a certain sense, whatever it may be, right? It can breathe, has a heartbeat, but it's dead, and here's the important thing, it's deader than a trefa. Because a trefa is dead in the sense that you can't murder him, but you don't have to mourn for a trefa. You're not allowed to bury a trefa. Right? A kohen can walk into a room with a trefa, right? There are three kohanim in the room, at least, that I'm aware of. They're all allowed to be here, even if I really am a trefa. So a trefa
is only dead for the purposes of murder. But a zombie is really, really dead. And a zombie is not only dead for the purposes of murder, a zombie is dead to the point that a coin can't walk into a room with a zombie. And lots of time, maybe it's okay to bury a zombie. Now we have an interesting definition of a zombie. A zombie is a body which has a soul in it, but the soul is not possessing the body. The soul is imprisoned in the body.
But the case that he's giving,
yes,
maybe a coin can't be in the same room just because, you know, like, it's inevitable that the person is in the process of dying is going to die while the coin is.
So that's a very reasonable understanding of the Talmud. Right, but it's not, I think the Shulchan says, he is dead. Right, the language he quotes, that he says the Kohanim are forbidden to become Tameh, not Kohanim are forbidden to be in the room because they might become Tameh. He says Kohanim are forbidden to become Tameh. So I think he really thinks that he's dead. But he doesn't deny that there's still a Neshama within it. Okay, so that's our first move, which is going to animate what we do throughout the series, is the claim that really there are three categories, and that third category, the zombie, has been insufficiently appreciated in previous philosophic discourse, and many things will change.
That's not walking around, it's just that. This is a guy for a few moments before he dies.
He broke his neck. We have one case of it.
But the question is, how, if he's going to be dead in the next couple of minutes?
I have no idea.
But there are people who've broken their necks and they can't move to the neck down, and they.
Yeah.
Are they considered them dead?
So we have to figure out exactly what the case is. He says, you know, the neck has to be broken and much of the flesh severed. So we have a fairly clear definition. But that's the interesting thing to me. There's a physical definition, and then there's a metaphysical definition. Right. So the physical definition is a case of a metaphysical phenomenon. The metaphysical phenomenon is a soul trapped in a body. Right. This is an example of the physical phenomenon. The question is, are there other examples, other physical phenomena, that would also instantiate this metaphysical phenomena? If you think of it as just, oh, that one case, okay, that's not a big deal. But if you think, if you can think of a whole set of cases, right, and this is just an example, then the category becomes really important. Okay, that's move number one. Now, what are, right, so I have gone out of my way so far not to give any definition to zombie. We've given definition to trefa, but not to zombie. But not to ghost. What I want to do is offer you Rav Moshe Feinstein's definition of ghost in several levels. And then I want to move on to whether his definition is the only possible definition. His definition has enormous impact on the way in which end-of-life ethics is constructed nowadays. Any other? The first thing he tells you is, you have to understand there's a difference between treifut in animals and treifut in human beings. So the Mishnah in Chulin has this chapter called Elu Treifut. And what is that chapter? It's a list of holes in organs which make an animal a treifa. And if you make an animal a treifa, then it is treif. That's where the word treif comes from. It's an animal that has a puncture or a hole in a particular particular set of organs. Now there's a whole history behind this, which is the problem, is that so presumably there's a debate about whether trefoot can ever live or not, whether all trefoot die within 12 months of the Talmud, or whether most trefoot die within 12 months. The problem that people noticed immediately after the Talmud is lots of these animals didn't die at all. And so all of the laws of treifut kind of stopped making sense as a physical phenomenon, because there were too many animals that had these kinds of punctures and didn't die. And the famous case we have most recently of this is conceivably the fact that we actually, a hole in a cow's stomach, it makes it a treifa, and it turns out that we overfeed our dairy cows such that they get enormous gas problems, and guess how you solve the problem of gas in dairy cows? With a puncture there sometimes, which means you put a hole in them. Now, the problem is that all our dairy cows are treifas. Now, we don't put puncture them because we want them to die. We puncture them because we want them to live, because if we don't puncture them, then they go. Right, we puncture dairy cows so that, right, so they won't die. But the problem is, right, we have this real issue that we are now putting holes in animal stomachs in order to help them live. Whereas the halakhic category seems to think that putting holes in animals makes them die. So we have all sorts of, we have for 1,000 years tried our various ways out of this. In this particular way, the most inventive way is to claim that it's only perpendicular holes that make animals specialists, but diagonal holes don't. Right. I kid you not, that's our most prevalent way out of the to keep all our milk kosher.
Does that affect what about the meat?
Same way, not a trefa.
So then the things that would have been trefa, 200 years ago are now kosher.
So the answer is no, right? In order to get this, we have to claim no. Nobody ever thought animals with diagonal punctures were a trefa. It was always a perpendicular puncture. But okay, right, so we have problems with this, and basically, we all know that basically, trefot became a. We don't in practice expect animals that are trefot to die. They just have trefot, but we still check them. For, that's what we call glatt kosher, right? Glatt kosher means you blow up the lung of the animal and inspect it for punctures. Right, if you see any kind of lesions on the lungs, you assume they're a healed puncture. And if you treat the animal as not kosher and non-glut meat, you'll rub it and see if it's actually just a blood clot, not scar tissue, and assume it doesn't have a puncture. But the whole purpose of it, but after you shaft the large animal, you blow up the lungs and you inspect it to see if its lungs have punctures. Okay. So Ramesh says that's only about animals. So now we use the same term, trefa, for animals and human beings, but Ramosha says it doesn't mean the same thing. But by animals, the category trace of Ramosha says, since, as you all point out, the things that kill animals will change every generation, but he asserts that the category of trace food for eating has to be metahistorical. And therefore, trace that are fixed at whatever were believed or actually did kill animals in the time of Chazal, and changes in technology which enable animals to live indefinitely with these punctures don't affect halakha at all. But he suggests, when it comes to human beings, a human being, I'm not really a traitor. Even though if I were an animal, I would be. Right? I'm not kosher. But as for any assassins out there who think they can get away with it, you can't. Because as a human being tracer, the only thing that makes a human being tracer is if you actually have a physical hole in a vital organ that will kill you within a year. Right? So the definition of tracer by human being carries the same conceptual definition as it does by animals, but it's practically entirely different. Tracer by human being is defined as a person who has a puncture in a vital organ that will kill them within a year. Okay, what about a ghost face? So Rav Moshe adds in a whole set of other... that meet our threshold of probability of death. Right? What that threshold of probability is broader than I want to do right now. Meet our threshold. Probable, like super probable, highly probable, close to inevitable, whichever one you want. But it has to be a puncture. Right? It can't just be... Right, or certain organs, it can be a hypertrophy or an atrophy, but it can't just be that you have an infection. Right, or it can't, it probably can't be cancer in the overwhelming majority of cases. It doesn't have that kind of physical thing. What's a ghost face? So if you look at, so Rav Moshe introduces a theological definition of a ghost face at the end of source 4. He says, the law of a ghost face, who is a person who has no lack in his organs, and from that perspective could live forever. Just that human beings have to die because we ate the fruit of the tree of knowledge. So it goes into somebody who is dying, but they're dying not because of any specific lack in their body. They're dying because people die. And you know what? People don't die suddenly. They die gradually. So it goes into somebody whom you can look at and you say, you know what? The poison of the tree of knowledge is coming home to them.
Okay, the Ramosha goes further, right? He says, if you look at the fourth five, he says,
the difference between a dangerously, what's the difference between a terminally ill person and a ghost? What he says is, you, in your question, he says, you talked about a ghost, but I didn't use the word ghost, because I used the word ghost in a very precise meaning. A ghost means somebody whom, A, you can't touch them. B, it's not possible to treat them for this or any other illnesses. All right, so there's two criteria for ghost. A, is that you can't touch them. Why? Because if you touch them, you'll kill them. They're that fragile. And B, right, there's no possibility of treatment. Yes?
Is that a consequence or a requirement, a defining factor?
That's a fair question. It's a fair question. We don't know. Right, all we know is that it's part of our identification marking of ghost face. It is somebody whom touch is a risk of, right, just touching is a risk of death. And here's another criteria. It says, Gesita, which it says, is recognizable to those who understand and spend time with the fish. But if you don't, you have to know it. I can't describe it to you. People usually talk nowadays about like death rattle or something like that, but it's words. You don't have it. He says, also, by the way, ghosts can't live more than 3 days. And that, he says, right, so the halakha actually is that if a person comes over to you and says, I saw your relative 3 days ago and he was a ghost, you start mourning. So there's a presumption that he's going to die. So let's watch how we...
He's already dead when he heard the news.
So we set up the paradox very starkly, right, that a trefa can live for 12 months and be walking around, and it's not murder to kill him. A ghost says he's inevitably dead within 3 days, and it is murder to kill him. Right, that's the paradox at the heart. Now, Rav Moshe goes on to say in source number 6, he says, regarding the prohibition against touching a ghost, says, regarding the signs of gesisa, I have heard that doctors do not recognize these. Perhaps because with regard to treatment there is no difference, because the nations of the world are not concerned that touching and dealing will lead to loss of nefesh, and they don't think this is prohibited for two reasons. One, they don't know that it's forbidden to touch a ghost face, and the one who touches a ghost face is considered to be a murderer. And two, you know, if they agree that it's killing, they just don't care so much. They're going to pass position assisted suicide law anyway. What's the big deal? Okay, so now
we end up with, we have a definition of trefa. Trefa is somebody who has a particular kind of wound or puncture that will, according to current medical opinion, kill them within 12 months, even though from all external perspectives they appear perfectly healthy. A ghost is somebody who is so obviously dying that A, the symptoms are recognizable, B, it's 100% that they're going to die within 3 days, and C, even touching them is a risk of death. So that's the way that Rav Moshe sets it up, and that's a very conventional current definition of ghost face, and all sorts of interesting implications. One of them is that it's almost impossible to test whether somebody is dead by any kinds of contact means. Because the test might kill them. Another is the circumstances where it should be impossible for relatives to hold their dying relative's hand. Right? So there's a whole set of challenging consequences to this. And the other thing is, all of you immediately sort of said your head, what? Is that really true? Are there people whom mere touch can cause to die? That the signs of a ghost face are identifiable, that I think will be confirmed probably by the medical professionals in the room. That if you deal with dying patients, you can get there. Also, apparently, there are expert cats. There was a very big AOL story a number of years ago about a cat in a nursing home that you knew which patient was dying next, because the cat, Oscar, I think his name was, would, when the patient was dying, that's the bed he would go on to that night. So apparently this was a cat that was good at determining ghost
face. Carrying by plague,
probably. No, no one was necessarily. But it's a very challenging notion, this is that touch can lead to death. So the last thing I want to do tonight, now we have definitions, right? Again, to be clear, we have the ghost face who is imminently dying in 3 days, but does not have that kind of specific wound. The trefa who has that wound which will kill him only within 12 months, and a zombie who is a soul in prison, right, the soul is imprisoned in the body. But we have the side definition of a ghost face is that somebody who's in the position of a ghost face, you're not allowed to touch because you might kill them. So I want to argue in the last 7 minutes that that position, although it is very broadly held in contemporary halacha and has been for hundreds of years, possibly reasonably well held for 1,000 years, I want to argue that actually it's a mistake. And I'll try and show you why I think it's a mistake, and then you can decide for yourself whether that should have any impact on halacha or not. I think it should. So if you turn to page 6, the first I gave you just a list of the possible ways in which the category of death can be divided. But I'm interested in the first 7. The first 7 says that they perform all actions necessary to the dead on Shabbat. They anoint and rinse him so long as they move none of his limbs. They remove the cushion from underneath him and place him on the sand so that he won't putrefy and never preparation. They tie the cheeks to preserve what the faithful look like. Tangents, you can also do things on Shabbat like that. They don't close the eyes of the dead on Shabbat, nor during the week together with the departure of the nefesh, and one who closes the eyes together with the departure of the nefesh is considered a bloodshed. So what's the context of this Mishnah? The problem is the dead body is
dead.
And because they're dead on Shabbat, they are mukta. Right, so this is a Mishnah which tries to figure out how you deal with the necessities of kavod hamet, of honoring the threat of honoring the dead, as opposed to the prohibition of mukta. And it tells you there's a whole set of things you can do, like you can anoint and rinse it, but you can't move it. Okay? And you also can't close the eyes. And by the way, during the week, you can't close the eyes, right? You can't close the eyes at the moment of death either. And if you close the eyes at the moment of death, even during the week, this is separate from Shabbat, right? Then you're considered a bloodshed. Why? So this practice is continued on Shabbat 151b, right, or very parallel to this. Now, somebody who closes the eyes as the nefesh is leaving, they're considered a bloodshedder. It's like a candle, is the very same image, a candle that is going out. You put your finger on the candle, and the candle goes out. Okay, so closing the eyes as the soul is departing is putting a finger on the candle. And what it is the equivalent of filling a term, right? I'll try to. The ghost face. Right? You have a person, right? A ghost face is a flickering candle. And a ghost face, right, and you put your finger on the candle goes out. Okay, that's what the Talmud says. Okay. Now there's a Mishnah that shows up in various contexts. And we'll read it first in the far right column. The Brighton of El Rabasi, and here's what it says. The ghost is like one who is living for all purposes. So I'm reading down the right hand column. The ghost is Harehu Kakai L'Chol Dvarav. He's like living for all purposes. Ain Koshen Ed L'Chayav. You cannot tie up his cheek. Does that sound familiar? Right. When can you tie up his cheek? When he's dead on Shabbat. Okay? And you can't anoint him. When can you anoint him? When he's dead, on Shabbat. Okay, so what is this brisa? This brisa is the inverse of the Mishnah in Shabbat. Mishnah in Shabbat says, these are the things that you can do after he's dead, as long as you avoid mukta. This brisa is a list of the things that you can't do while he's alive. What can't you do while he's alive? All the things that you're going to do for him when he's dead. And the import of the Braita all the way through is don't treat someone who's still alive, who's imminently dying as if they're dead. You don't dig their grave. You don't engage in the physical preparations that treat them like a corpse. Okay? You have two Braitas which have roughly the same list, but one of them is in the context of things that you can do on Shabbat because he's already dead, and one of the list of things you can't do during the week because he's not yet dead. Those brachos converge on the question of, which I have labeled as H here, in the first column, right? They each end by telling you You can't close the eyes while he's dying. Okay, however, the Braisa which talks about muktzah on Shabbat has an exception. There's one thing that even though you would do it ordinarily when you're taking care of the dead, you can't do on Shabbat. And what is it you can't do? You can't move him. Why can't you move him? Because he's muktzah. Okay? Whereas on a weekday, right, when you're preparing a dead body, you have to move it. So the brachos converge on the right. They each have the warning: don't close the eyes before he says. But they have a difference in that on Shabbat is that the Shabbat brachos tells you don't move him, and the brachos in Adel Rabati tells you that you of course that you have to do things that do involve moving him. And this is, by the way, if you go through all the three, that's consistent. There are lots of things that you're supposed to do involving moving him during the week, but on Shabbat you only do the things that don't involve moving him because he's Muslim. So I gave you three versions of the Braisa, and you'll see how if you look at the columns, you can see how they line up. No, see, that's not true. That's exactly right. There is nothing whatsoever wrong with touching a Muslim object if you don't move it. Right? That's exactly what causes it. Because we teach people that they're not allowed to touch mukta objects, but there's absolutely no prohibition in touching mukta objects. The prohibition is moving mukta objects or making use of mukta objects. Okay, but that's exactly what happens. What happens is that when you get to the Riddick and many other people, the two brachos converge. And where do they converge? They converge in the metaphor of the candle. What happens is, the metaphor of the candle originally meant that you don't close someone's eyes as they're dying. Why? Because the idea is that is something that is symbolically or actually treated as actually hastening their death. Why? Because closing their eyes, sucks out the last spark of life, literally, right? So that's why you're putting your finger on the candle. I mean, you all understand whatever you think, symbolically, the metaphysically, whatever it is, that closing the eyes means the person, right, is the final stage of death. But it happens that in order that closing their eyes is also an example on Shabbat of moving part of the person's body. This is why the Braisa of Shabbat says you can't do it on Shabbat or during the week. You can't do it on Shabbat after he's already dead, because it's muktzah, and you can't do it before he's dead because it's murder. But because on Shabbat, it's also framed as touch and move. So a version of the metaphor develops, which you can find on the bottom of column 3 in the list, where he says, right, as opposed to the metaphor being when you put your finger on the candle, what he says is, this is similar to Lamad Zavar Devel, and there Hamitaktes, to a flickering candle, Shekevan Shenogea Boadam. When a person touches it, the candle goes out. So what happened over time was, that the flickering candle metaphor, which was supposed to be, originally was a metaphor specifically related to the closing of the eyes. Right? It was a metaphor about putting out the last flicker of soul. Right? Became understood as being a metaphor about the fragility of life, so that even touching it makes it go out. Now, it's not really true. Touching a candle doesn't make it go out. You have to put your finger on the flame. But because the language developed in such a way as just touching it, so now from this point on, you can trace throughout history, you can trace the people who quote the metaphor as putting their finger on the flame, and the people who quote the metaphor as touching the candle. And I'm arguing that the original version of the metaphor is putting out the flame, and the idea that you cannot touch a ghost arises from the mistransfer of the metaphor. Now, does that play out logically? So it turns out that the Shulchan Aruch quotes the metaphor with the version and the halakha, the version that talks about moving the dead person, the dying person, not about touching them. If you look back at Rabbi Feinstein's citation, you'll say, and everyone knows you can't touch a ghost. And what does he quote? The Shach, the commentary of the Shulchan Aruch. Why? Because he can't quote the Shulchan Aruch. And not only that, but the other sources he quotes don't say it either.
Is that potentially an
So the Ramah doesn't really say it either, although we'll look at the Ramah in 3 weeks, but the Ramah doesn't really say it either. Actually, I think if you trace it through, you'll see that the majority of the tradition has, right, both Ashkenazi and Sephardi, right, even though the Rif has it this way. The Rif actually has it both ways in different places. Right, I didn't show you that. Here the Rif has it with one way, in another place the Rif goes the other way. It doesn't see the difference between them, probably. I think that if you recognize that there are the two first versions of the metaphors, you can look back and say, oh, touch is only one of two options. You'll see the Shulchan Aruch does not quote the one that bans touch. Right, so that's wrap up for the first week. You have the Trefa, who we're understanding is somebody who has a physical condition that will kill them, a particular kind of physical condition that will kill them within 12 months, and they're a little bit dead. There's the Ghosti, who is somebody who is dying imminently, and they're not at all dead. There's the Zombie, who is all the way dead already, just still has a soul in their body. And the question of what you're letting, right, so those are all enough units in terms of murder, but there's also Halakha, which generally says that even that it's so, because killing a ghost face is murder, you're not even allowed to touch somebody who's dying, and that I want to suggest arose from an error, and that at least in certain circumstances where it would be very difficult to talk him that way, we should not talk him that way, and in fact that's not the bulk of the tradition. At the same time, recognizing that, you know, the public sphere in a shul, and Rav Moshe clearly held entirely the opposite, and to talk to him against Rav Moshe is something that takes very broad shoulders. Thank you much very much for listening, and we'll see you in 8 days.
Continue with Mars in 30 seconds. Thank you.